Good morning. Thank you for having me. I'll start with a very short reading from a book I highly recommend to you called Evicted. It's by Matthew Desmond. And towards the conclusion, he writes, "What we need most is a housing program for the unlucky majority, the millions of poor families struggling unassisted in the private market that promotes the values most of us support: security, fairness, and equal opportunity." Thank you again for welcoming me into your community. My name is Mark Jolin. I have been on this journey around the issue of homelessness for most of my life. It started out in college in Philadelphia, and then I came back home to Portland where I grew up in 1992 and started working at Transition Projects, one of our big shelter providers in town. I was the assistant manager at the St. Francis Dining Hall in Southeast Portland, and have essentially continued doing work in and around this issue of homelessness since then. And from the earliest days, and it started at St. Francis really, and the founding of an organization called JOIN, which was built from the spirit of liberation theology, there's been a quote that has stayed with me and guided my work and how I think about the work, and it's one that many of you are probably very familiar with, but I'll read it. It's from Dorothy Day. "We've all known the long loneliness, and we have learned that the only solution is love, and that love comes with community. For more than 4,000 people, every night in our community, the long loneliness looks like finding a way to stay warm with your family, sleeping in a car parked next to Oregon Park, a car that is also filled with what's left of your worldly possessions. It's huddling under blankets and a tarp in the doorway of a business on Hawthorne that will need you to be up and moved along by 7 a.m. It's waking up at 6 a.m. in a shelter with 100 other people, leaving to go stand in line for an hour to get a warm breakfast, then getting on a train to a day center and waiting 2 hours to get a shower, then traveling to stand in line for an hour for lunch, then putting your name on a waiting list for housing that is 2 years long, then going to yet another place and standing in line again for dinner, and finally lining up to get into shelter. Or the long loneliness may be being forced to the streets by a family that can't accept that you're gay and finding yourself exploited by predators on those streets. Or it may be coming back from serving your country in a war and being so overwhelmed by by the trauma that you lose all the relationships that had sustained you and you retreat to a remote camp on the Sandy Delta. Or it may be Mike's experience. He's someone I first met when I got to join in 2006. I was the executive director there for 8 years. Mike suffered a midlife psychotic break. A psychotic break is defined as a feature of mental illness typically characterized by radical changes in personality, impaired functioning, and a distorted or non-existent sense of objective reality. At the time of his break, he had a fairly typical middle-class existence working in the construction industry in another state. Then all of a sudden, after that break, for reasons he could not make sense of, no one was responding to him the way they used to. Little by little, everything that defined who he was fell away. His marriage, his friendships, his house, his job, his car. And because he didn't understand why, he became angrier and angrier. He just wanted things to be back the way they were. Drugs and alcohol helped ease the pain, but they didn't take away the loneliness. He left where he'd been, thinking he could rebuild life in another city. But he arrived in Portland, and things were no better. He wound up on the streets. His behaviors got him excluded from multiple agencies and programs. He ran into trouble with the police. He eventually met a worker at Join. He was grateful to be offered the assistance, but he routinely lashed out, even at the people who were trying to help him. Sitting with a caseworker, he'd start out screaming at them, literally screaming at them that they weren't doing enough to help, and then breaking down in tears and saying over and over again, "Why is this happening? I just want my life back." To him, truly, none of it made sense. Because of his behaviors, he couldn't stay in shelters. With the help of a disability payment, rent assistance, and his join workers, he would find his way into permanent housing, but he'd inevitably wind up in conflicts with his neighbors and get evicted. After a few months back out on the street, with the help of his worker, he'd get back into housing, this time different kind of housing, a single family house instead of an apartment, away from others, with less potential conflict, but eventually something would happen that would trigger his anger. He'd lose the housing and he'd be back on the street again, this time more frustrated, more hopeless. Mike came running up to my car just 2 weeks ago as I was driving down Hawthorne. I've now known him for 10 years. He came up to tell me that he was headed to Florida again. This has always been a part of Mike's story. He wants to believe that the problems he is having are related to the city he has chosen to live in. And if only he could get to a different city, he'd be able to rebuild his life. In the years I've known him, he's left Portland and returned to Portland multiple times. When I left my position as executive director at Join 2 years ago, I had a set of keys in my desk that Mike had given me the last time he left for Florida, wishing, as he said, quote, "this hellhole of a town, good riddance." I don't want to use this talk to go down the debunking myths and stereotypes, but as an aside, I do want to say that I hope you'll remember Mike's story the next time someone says things like, "some of those people just choose to be homeless," or "if they don't want to go to shelter, they must be uninterested in services," or "the problem is people come to Portland because we have such great services." Mike is just one example of how oversimplistic and thus off the mark these kinds of statements typically are, and trust me, they are myths. So, but coming back to Dorothy Day, every person experiencing homelessness in our community is experiencing their very personal long loneliness. And part of overcoming that loneliness is removing the material hardship that is, by definition, present in the experience of homelessness. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. But as Dorothy Day calls out, the love that comes from feeling that you are part of a community, truly believing that you are welcome and belong to a community, is perhaps just as important to emerging from the long loneliness of homelessness. From my perspective, this has always been and will always have profound implications for our community's work on ending homelessness, both in terms of what we are trying to accomplish and how we accomplish it. At one level, ending homelessness is a very material activity. We are working to make sure that every person in our community has safe, affordable, permanent housing. And accomplishing that absolutely has material elements. By definition, we cannot end someone's homelessness if we cannot offer them an apartment that they can afford to rent. That is why the lack of 30,000 affordable units for very low income in our very low income families in our community is one of the biggest challenges we face to ending homelessness. It's also why the recent bond measure, the construction excise tax that the city of Portland adopted, inclusionary zoning, and other increases in funding for affordable housing are so critical, and why I'm excited about conversations that are happening about just cause eviction standards and the exploration of rent stabilization measures. But fundamentally, ending homelessness in our community is also about ensuring that people experiencing homelessness feel loved, that they truly believe that they belong, that they matter. It is out of this sense of belonging that hope arises, hope that no matter how bad things are right now, if I do everything I can, I will find the support I need and I will succeed in ending my homelessness. The tragedy of Mike's mental illness is that it makes it so hard for him to hold on to hope. His behaviors make it incredibly hard for people to support him and make him feel like he belongs, so he repeatedly experiences people moving away from him, leaving him. He then acts out in ways that cause him to lose his housing, and he winds up back on the streets. Where he finds hope is in imagining another city, another community, where he will be more welcome, where he will belong. Understanding that ending homelessness is not just about helping people meet their material and biological needs, but also their need to feel loved, to belong, has profound implications for what we do and how we do it. As I said, we absolutely must invest in meeting the essential material and biological needs of people experiencing homelessness, but in doing so, we have to pay close attention to how we help meet those needs, and also that we are investing in helping people rebuild their connections to community. I'll give you a few examples of what this looks like. So in my current job as the director of a home for everyone in the Joint Office of Homeless Services, which is the government office created by the City of Portland and Multnomah County to deliver the funding to dozens of nonprofits that work in ending homelessness, I'm in part responsible for ensuring that the way the work is happening is as effective as possible. For years in our community, we have provided case management services as part of how we respond to people who are experiencing homelessness. Case management, over time, evolved into a quasi-professional practice modeled or resembling a very clinical encounter, with the case manager calling a client into their office, sitting across a desk from them for an hour with a stack of forms, asking a series of probing and deeply personal questions, notably without revealing anything similarly personal about themselves, and then issuing a diagnosis of what it was that ails the client, and writing a prescription in the form of a case plan that the client should follow in order to fix what ails them. At best, this approach did nothing to create a sense of belonging for the person experiencing homelessness, and in many cases, it had the opposite effect, further alienating the person seeking services, emphasizing their problems rather than their strengths, placing them in a subordinate position to the case manager, someone who often did not look like them and did not share anything about themselves to indicate that they understood or had gone through a similar kind of experience. So several years ago, Multnomah County, working with many of its nonprofits, began moving away from traditional case management toward what we call assertive engagement. And at its core, this approach is the recognition that our ability to effectively support someone depends as much on the relationship we offer them, the sense of belonging and the resulting hope that we're able to create, as on any material benefit that we might be able to provide. It uses trauma-informed, culturally responsive, and strengths-based practices, and the relationship is developed out in the field, in the community, wherever it feels best and most empowering to the person we are working to serve. This is also why we are increasingly using peer mentorship models throughout our community, because of the power that comes from working with people you know have been there themselves. Another example is emergency shelter, and if you follow the issue of homelessness, it has been very much in the news in our community. There's been a lot of discussion about opening the Wapato Jail as a 500-bed shelter because it's there, because there are beds, because there are showers. But it is also 12 miles from downtown Portland. It's in an entirely industrial area, miles from the nearest grocery store, community center, church, school, or apartment building. It was often argued that we could overcome the isolation of the jail by bringing all of the services that people needed to the site. But that would not overcome the kind of isolation from community that I'm talking about. How do I create a feeling of belonging if I tell someone who is experiencing homelessness that if they want shelter and a shower and other services, they'll need to share a space with 500 other similarly struggling people in a remote industrial area where they'll struggle to have contact with any of the other people and institutions that make up our community? If for financial and practical reasons we simply had no choice but to use Wapato to offer 500 people the basic safety of shelter and beds, perhaps these concerns would have been set aside. But we certainly weren't going to start there. And as a result, in the last year, we've created almost 600 year-round shelter beds. To be clear, all offering beds and showers and basic safety, but all located in the community, near stores, near restaurants, near churches, transportation, neighborhoods, schools, and apartment complexes. Just up the street here, Do Good Multnomah opened a 25-bed veteran shelter in the last year. We opened a 90-bed shelter for women with domestic violence-specific services in Gresham. We opened a 200-person shelter that is an all-comer shelter. People can come with their pets and their partners and their belongings on 122nd and Gleason. We just opened another 60 beds of winter shelter right in the middle of downtown, near where many of our services are concentrated. We opened the first community couple shelter for 120 people. Again, they can bring their animals and their possessions. They don't have to promise to engage in case management. They don't have to promise to engage in sobriety services. They just come. It's in Westmoreland. So we have created the shelter capacity that Wapato would have offered us, but we've done it in a way that is truly supportive of the people, both in terms of their material needs and facilitates their sense of belonging in the community, the larger community, a facilitation, a sense of belonging that will actually increase the chances that they're successfully going to make it out of those shelters and back into permanent housing. This same level of relationship, understanding about the importance of relationship and creating a sense of belonging, is very real when we start talking about how to manage camping and the kinds of issues that draw so much attention in our community and that do necessarily involve the police and do necessarily involve accountability for behaviors in public spaces. Communities that have taken a very heavy-handed law enforcement approach see no benefit from that, because the problem isn't fundamentally a law enforcement issue when someone is sleeping outside and doesn't have another place to be and to live their private lives. It's fundamentally an economic and a social justice issue. Coming at somebody who is hopeless because they see no path for themselves, they don't feel a sense of belonging, and telling them they're not allowed to sleep and being heavy-handed about that and telling them to make a different or a better decision doesn't lead to a better outcome. It just leads to anger, people being moved around, people being arrested. So even as we as a community tackle the challenges associated with having folks sleeping out on our streets, we have to come at that, including through our police force, and we have done that. How can a police officer, yes, ensure that the public spaces are being shared and that we don't have people taking them over for long periods of time with their belongings, but do that in a way that recognizes that individual's dignity and that individual's needs and the challenges that they face? And so one example of this is the street youth, the folks that are often called summer travelers, 24 and under, who come to downtown Portland. For years, we had a very aggressive enforcement strategy. The thought was, if we just confront folks, they'll choose someplace else to go. And it didn't work. Travelers came back, and we had all kinds of conflicts in the downtown core on Hawthorne for years. 2 years ago, the police adopted a different approach, which was fundamentally about getting to know the young people who were hanging out on the corners. not coming to enforce, but coming to get to know them. Why were they there? What were they doing? What did they need? Who were they as people? They had a walking beat of officers. That was their job. They weren't there to issue tickets. They weren't there to tell people they had to leave. They built those relationships. And as much as we've had challenges in other areas of camping over the last 2 years, if you follow it in the media, we've had very few problems with the youth who come into town, in part because that walking beat has changed the dynamic. It has changed the nature of the relationship. So that the young people are changing their behaviors downtown, not because they're being threatened with a citation, but because they know the officer. The officer has demonstrated a concern for who they are as people, and they're being told they're welcome here, but they also need to be good neighbors. And if they can do that, they're going to be just fine, and the police are going to leave them alone. So this dynamic plays itself out at every level. I'm mindful of our time. So let me say just a couple of other things, because I was definitely charged with sharing with you some of the things that you can do. And given how I've set this up, there are both the material things that you can do, and there are the things that you can do to help make people feel loved and feel like they are welcome and belong in this community. So let's start on the material side. Our community's plan, A Home for Everyone, which I'm tasked with helping implement, is a community-wide plan. It's a commitment to collective impact, meaning that we are aligning the work of all of our different funders and community partners with the efforts of the people who are working to end their own homelessness to maximize the number of people who we can help in this community. As I said, we have about 4,000 people on any given night who are experiencing homelessness now. Last year, through the efforts of A Home for Everyone, meaning the large coalition of nonprofits that do this work, and the volunteers and the faith organizations, we were able to help over 9,000 people avoid becoming homeless in the first place. For the people who we're talking about here, that is a wonderful outcome, much better than if they had become homeless and then had to figure out how to get back into housing. Retains the stability of that housing, their connections to their community, the school that their children are attending. Whenever possible, we want to prevent someone from becoming homeless in the first place. So over 9,000 people, through some form of public support, were able to make that happen. If someone does become homeless, the next best option is not to have them go to a shelter, but to go back into permanent housing. When we talk about housing first, that's what we mean. We mean that if it is possible to move somebody directly into a housing, permanent housing tomorrow, that's what we want to have happen, right? Wherever they are, if they're doubled up, they're fleeing a domestic violence situation, they're in the shelter bed, our priority is to get them back into their own place as quickly as possible. With the collective efforts, last year, 4,600 people moved off the streets, out of shelter, back into permanent housing. And because despite all of those efforts, we're only able to meet a fraction of the need out there, we do have to have shelter. We expanded shelter capacity by 100% over the last year in terms of publicly funded shelter beds. And more than 6,600 people were able to access emergency shelter last year. But again, it's just a fraction of the need. And so on the material side, we need the community's continued support, first and foremost, to expand the number of deeply affordable housing units available in our community. We cannot prevent or end homelessness if housing is not affordable to very low-income people in our community. We need your support at the federal, state, and local levels to continue to invest in critical homeless services. Mental health and physical health services, employment services, child care, education and training resources. There's a state budget session coming up where a lot of core services are at stake. And both the city and the county, which combined put over $40 million a year into achieving what we're currently able to achieve, are going to have, they're both going to have difficult budget years this year. We need you to continue to support individual organizations. The nonprofits that work on homeless services in our community, many of them rely on public funding, but they also rely on volunteers and faith communities and individuals to donate. Some of them focus on prevention, some do housing placement, some do shelter. As I just said, we need all of those. There are organizations that work with specific cultural and ethnic communities. There are organizations that focus on domestic violence. There are organizations that focus on youth. Go where your heart takes you. They are all important. Every single one of them is playing a vital role in this collective effort that we've undertaken. If you own property, rent to somebody who has a difficult rental history. If you're a small business, consider employing somebody who's got a challenged history with employment or housing or who's coming out of the criminal justice system. Being a second chance landlord or a second chance employer is an absolutely essential role in our community. And do sock drives. Serve meals. That matters too. 8 years at Join, I cannot tell you how many thousands of times we had to tell someone, I'm sorry, I don't have another dry pair of socks for you, we're out. And now let's talk about how we help people build a sense of community. It sounds like this congregation is already involved in the New City Initiative and the Village Support Network. You know, that is in part about helping a family financially. But that is as much or more about helping that family feel loved and cared for and supported as they struggle to maintain the housing that was so hard fought for them. That kind of participation in the community, welcoming people into your life, welcoming people into the community organizations that you are a part of and just sharing yourselves with them, matters a lot. You often hear homeless advocates say, just look people in the eyes when you see them. Even when you say, no, I'm sorry, I can't help you, at least acknowledge them. What is that about? That's about the thing I'm talking about here. That's about reinforcing that sense that I see you, you are a part of this community, and even though I can't or I'm not willing to give you money, that doesn't mean that I can't acknowledge that you and I are in this community together. Fight back, please, against the dehumanizing rhetoric about people experiencing homelessness that we too often hear in our local media, on social media, on Nextdoor. Respond, write stories. Homeless people are no more saints than the rest of us. Homeless people make bad decisions. We all make bad decisions. We can, and we do in our lives, hold each other accountable, expect to be treated with respect and dignity in both directions. I have that expectation of the people in my life, whether they're homeless or not. But we cannot treat people as the other, as not like us, as not also people, simply because they're experiencing homelessness. And too often the language that gets used and circulated around homelessness does just that. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, remember that how you deliver whatever material support you are offering matters as much as the support itself. Consider that receiving a hot meal will help someone meet their biological needs, but how they receive it can either cast them deeper into their loneliness or help pull them out of it by creating a sense of belonging. So when you go to give money or volunteer, consider how the service is being provided. Is the organization that you're funding or the volunteer work you are doing creating the sense of belonging that fosters the hope in those receiving the services that they will need to escape the long loneliness of homelessness? Or is it actually making it harder for them because it doesn't truly acknowledge their role in their own lives, their own humanity? It doesn't truly foster a relationship of inclusion and belonging. So I ask you to remember Mike. I always do. The solutions to homelessness lie in the reading that I started with. We need comprehensive housing programs. We need to make the financial investments in people that it will take, and we can end homelessness. But they also lie in the kind of community that we create. Mike is the guy who is often vilified in the press and on social media, and he is a challenging person. He has challenged me many a times. I wanted to bar him from services at Join more than once because of how he was treating the workers in our organization. But he is not homeless because of bad choices. As I said,